Hello, and welcome to the National Geographic Society program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. The articles I'll be reading today were all published in May of 2025 by the Geographic Society. I'll begin with this article. These birds carry a toxin deadlier than cyanide. New Guinea is home to some of the world's most toxic birds. Why they contain poison and how they withstand it is still a source of scientific mystery. It's written by Sandy Ong. In the summer of 1989, Jack Dumbacher was a fresh-faced ornithologist in training on his maiden expedition to the lush rainforests of Papua New Guinea. One sticky afternoon, he noticed an unusual bird with gaudy black and orange feathers entangled in his missed nets. But as Dumbacher tried to set it free, the hooded pitohu scratched him. "They're J-sized birds with needle-sharp claws and bills," says Dumbacher, who instinctively put the cut to his lips. "My mouth started to tingle and burn, and then went numb, lasting until the night." When Dumbacher consulted his local guides, they nodded knowingly, telling him how villagers would avoid the rubbish birds, eating them only if they were skinned and specially prepared. Curiosity piqued, the then graduate student at the University of Chicago spent the next year collecting pitohu samples and searching for a chemist back home who could pinpoint the source of the peculiar sensations. In 1992, Dumbacher and his collaborators announced their astonishing findings. Hooded pitohus carry batrachotoxin. The toxin is deadlier than cyanide and is among the most lethal substances in the animal kingdom. It's the same substance found in certain poison dart frogs halfway around the world. Since then, at least a dozen other avian species, out of more than 10,500 known to science, have been identified as toxic. Some members of this select group, such as the European quail, North American ruffed grouse, and European hoopoes, are found outside of New Guinea and contain different toxins. The majority, however, are batrachotoxin carrying and endemic to the world's second largest island, including at least five other pitohu species and blue-capped ifrit. But 35 years on from Dumbacher's serendipitous discovery, much remains a mystery about New Guinea's poisonous birds. There's a ton that we don't know, from the ecology of the birds to how they use batrachotoxin for defense and where they get it from, says Dumbacher. Now, California Academy of Sciences curator of birds and mammals. He last visited the island in 2011, and another team of scientists, led by ecologist Knud Johnson from the Swedish Museum of Natural History and evolutionary and community biologist Kaysun Bodawata at the University of Copenhagen, are continuing Dumbacher's research. Already they've made inroads, identifying two new toxic bird species in 2023, the first discovery in nearly two decades. They plan to visit Papua New Guinea annually until 2028. They hope to answer a key question. Where does the toxin, believed to protect the birds from predators and parasites, come from? You are what you eat. One theory for the origin of this poison is the bird's diet. It's been put forth that they eat these chlorocene beetles, and that's how they get their toxin, says Johnson. But in reality, we don't know. Dumbacher, who in 2004 was the first to describe how batrachotoxin is present in both birds and beetles, doesn't believe the toxin originates in the tiny rice-sized insects. Most of the information suggests that beetles can't produce such steroidal alkaloids, he says. So it's very possible that the beetles are getting it from some other source, like soil mites or even a plant. To track batrachotoxin's origin, the researchers planned to collect poisonous birds and compare their stomach contents to insects caught in nearby traps. The idea is to try and home in on potential prey items that have the toxin, explains Johnson. It's very much looking like looking for a needle in a haystack, but that's the very first step that we can take. They've teamed up with Christine Bimmelmanns, a chemist at Germany's Saarland University, to pinpoint batrachotoxin and molecularly similar toxins in the samples already collected. Tests have shown that poisonous birds contain a mixture of toxic derivatives. Bimmelmann's lab has identified 6 so far, which can vary in concentration between individuals and species. How do birds remain immune? Another enduring mystery is how the birds protect themselves from the deadly toxin they carry. Batrachotoxin binds to sodium ion channels in nerve, muscle, and heart cells, resulting in numbness, convulsions, paralysis, and even death. It sits on these channels and keeps them open, so the nerves just go on twitching, says Johnson. Poisonous birds contain far less toxin than the golden poison frog, which carries enough batrachotoxin to kill 10 grown men. The hooded pitawa, the most toxic avian species, isn't lethal when handled or consumed. The long-standing theory that explains how the birds aren't killing themselves is that they, like poison dart frogs, contain mutations in their sodium channels, which prevents the toxin from binding, says Daniel Miner, a biophysicist at the University of California, San Francisco, who's not involved with Johnson and Bodawada's upcoming research expeditions. The same trait is found in the fugu pufferfish, blue-ringed octopus, and other poisonous animals that remain impervious to the toxins they carry. Indeed, when Johnson and his collaborators compared the genomes of 6 toxic bird species with their own non-toxic cousins within the same families, they discovered that poisonous birds contain multiple mutations in a gene encoding a specific sodium channel. However, when Miner's team conducted electrophysiological tests on genes cloned from the southern variable pitaway in a separate set of experiments, they were distraught to discover that the sodium channels remained sensitive to batrachotoxin, despite their mutations. Miner now believes that the bird's resistance lies in an as-yet unidentified protein which acts as a toxin sponge, binding to batrachotoxin and sequestering it. He and his colleagues work on saxitoxin, another protein that binds to sodium channels, provided this insight. Our lab shows that saxophilin, a protein found naturally in poison dart frogs, can scoop in and bind to saxitoxin with high efficiency. He explains, so maybe it's the same for batrachotoxin. Johnson and Bodawada think the two mechanisms might be complementary. Birds, anyway, need to transport batrachotoxin from the gut to the skin, says Bodawada, so they must have a transporter protein that facilitates this. Are there more? Scientists are keen to know whether more toxic birds exist. Johnson thinks it's highly likely. New Guinea's poisonous birds belong to the Corvides superfamily of birds, which comprise roughly 700 species worldwide, he says. New Guinea is home to 140 of them, and his team has so far studied just a fifth of them. Starting this November, his team will collect as many Corvides samples as possible from different parts of the island and screen them for batrachotoxin. They also plan to sequence at least one individual per species to identify sodium channel mutations. A more comprehensive genomic data set will also allow scientists to identify possible toxin sponge proteins, adds Bodawada. More broadly, the researchers want to study the super cool and crazy convergent evolution that's allowed for this special toxin resistance in both frogs and birds, as well as unrelated avian species within New Guinea and elsewhere in the world, Bodawada says. Understanding convergent adaptations by natural selection is a central goal in evolutionary biology, adds Johnson. The more scientists learn about what exists, the more questions they'll be able to ask about why they do. Maybe in 2 or 3 years, we'll have some new insights to share, says Bodawada. This is just the beginning. That completes the article. The title was "These Birds Carry a Toxin Deadlier Than Cyanide" by Sandy Ong. The second article is titled "How a New Pope is Elected." Who gets a vote? What do those smoke signals mean? And is there really as much intrigue as depicted in Hollywood? Here's what you need to know about papal succession, by Melissa Sartori. With the death of Pope Francis at the age of 88, the world will now turn to a pressing question: who will be the next pope, and how will he be elected? After Pope Benedict XVI's resignation in 2013, it took 2 long weeks for the Catholic faithful to find out who would be their next representative of God on earth. Crowds in St. Peter's Square at the Vatican let out a cheer as the white smoke from burned ballots signified a successful vote among the members of the College of Cardinals. It was the final act that sealed the intricate papal selection process that allegedly dates back to the time of Jesus Christ. Here's a closer look at the real story behind one of the Vatican's most mysterious and time-honored processes. What are the origins of the papacy? The Pope was originally the Bishop of Rome, a position first held by St. Peter, one of Jesus' 12 disciples, according to the Catholic Church. The Petrine theory states the authority given to Peter from Christ when he took the position in AD 30 has subsequently been handed down to each pope since his tenure. Peter was considered a papa, a Latin term used by Christians out of filial respect. At the time, the same title was used by esteemed churchmen throughout Christendom. The exclusivity over the word papa, from which pope derives, was not claimed by the Bishop of Rome until the 6th century. Papal primacy, the concept that the pope is the church's highest leader, became inexplicably linked to the papa in Rome, elevating the bishop of the city over all other bishops. How did we come to today's process of papal secession? Popular opinion, both of clergy and worshipers, was used to elect popes until the 11th century. Obviously, there was rarely a consensus. This led to disputed elections and anti-popes. Individuals with substantive, albeit false, claims to the papal seat. Pope Nicholas II issued a decree in 1059 articulating the process by which popes would be elected going forward, outlining the role of cardinal bishops as the electors. Nicholas II himself took the position between two anti-popes, showing just how contentious papal secession was. The decree of 1059 lessened the influence of the Roman aristocracy and lower clergy and laid the foundation for the College of Cardinals, formally established in 1150. Criteria for candidates, voting regulations, and the need to sequester electors were formalized, only to be altered and adjusted as flaws in the system became clear. The need for a two-thirds majority vote began in 1179. The number of cardinals went from no more than 30 during the later Middle Ages to 70 in 1586. More than four centuries later, Pope Paul VI set the maximum number of voting cardinals to 120 in 1975. The current age limit for voting cardinals was set at 80 years of age in 1970. With every pope, the number of cardinals increases. Today, there are 222 cardinals, with 120 eligible to vote. By the end of the year, eight more will be ineligible to vote as they celebrate their 80th birthday. When a pope dies or resigns, all members of the College of Cardinals are obligated to attend the election, called the conclave, barring poor health or exceeding the age limit. Resignation is the exception rather than the rule, however. Before Benedict XVI's resignation in 2013, the last pope to resign did so in 1415. Once the papal see is vacant, the official papal conclave begins within 15 to 20 days of the last pope's departure. This length of time was established in 1922 to allow cardinals sufficient time to travel to proceedings. How is a pope chosen today? Cardinals are all electors of the next pope, and technically all of them are candidates too. When the cardinals arrive in Rome, they are each assigned a titular local church to oversee and hold Mass at during their stay. It's also an avenue by which cardinals make their faces and names known to the world. Akin to a final campaign stop for a politician, the Sunday before a conclave makes for an odd scene, according to author and papal expert John Thavis. Thavis explained in 2013 that papal contenders are very careful not to say anything that appears to be campaigning. Once the College of Cardinals officially convenes, they are sealed in the Sistine Chapel until a new pope is chosen, barring extraordinary circumstances. They swear an oath to maintain the integrity of the conclave. Secrecy is of utmost importance, and only a few attendants are allowed to have any contact with voting cardinals. Preparation of the ballots, called pre-scrutiny, involves distribution, completion, and the designation of ballot collectors and counters. Casting one's vote, scrutiny is done in secret. During post-scrutiny, votes are tabulated, reaffirmed, and then burned. An initial vote takes place on the first day. If no one is elected, a maximum of 4 votes for each subsequent day of the conclave is held, with each unsuccessful group of ballots burned afterward. If 3 days of voting offers no new pope, members of the conclave take a full day for prayer and contemplation. If that 4-day cycle repeats 7 more times, a runoff between the 2 candidates who received the most support is held. The burning of ballots, or fumata, is the public's clue as to what has actually taken place within the confines of the Sistine Chapel during the conclave. In order for smoke to be seen at all, a temporary stove and chimney are installed in the Sistine Chapel before the conclave starts. It's not entirely clear when the practice of burning ballots began, but white smoke as a sign of a new pope only traces to the late 19th or early 20th century. An unsuccessful ballot, when burned, sends off black smoke. Until 2005, the Vatican added natural materials like wet straw for white and tarry pitch for black to the ballots. It wasn't until 2013 that the Vatican revealed the chemicals they adopted in 2005 for the purpose, a mix of potassium chlorate, lactose, and conifer resin for white, and potassium percolate, anthracene, and sulfur for black. 4 plumes of black smoke were seen in 2013 before white smoke finally appeared. Mere hours before that white smoke rose from the Vatican, a solitary white seagull perched itself atop the chimney. Observers took this to be a hopeful sign that the wait for a new pope was nearly over. They were right. Cardinal Jorge Mario Bergoglio, or Pope Francis, had been elected to the position by his peers. And that completes the article titled, How a New Pope is Elected, by Melissa Sartori. Our last article is This Island Has a Month-Long Holiday Celebration, by Jocelyn Greenberg. Bermuda Day, a holiday held on the 4th Friday in May each year in Bermuda, kicks off the island's start of summer and marks the rise in water and air temperatures, signaling to Bermudians that it's acceptable to swim in the ocean. An all-day celebration takes place, not just to signify the warm weather, but to celebrate the island's cultural heritage. What Bermuda Day celebrates. After decades of civil unrest and protest, which reached a climax in 1977, a royal commission was created to understand the unrest. A decision was made to change a holiday that traced its roots to Queen Victoria's birthday and was previously known as Empire Day, and then became Commonwealth Day, to Bermuda Day. The first Bermuda Day Heritage Parade was held on May 24, 1979, to celebrate Bermudian culture and promote civic pride. What was once a commemoration of the island's colonial ties and a recognition of the reach of the British Empire has been transformed into a quintessentially Bermudian celebration of our heritage, resilience, unity, and culture, says Jamari Douglas, Vice President of Marketing, Public Relations, and Communications for the Bermuda Tourism Authority. Today, Bermuda Day is embraced island-wide as a celebration of Bermuda's community of diverse people and cultures that have blended together over centuries to create the island we call home. Over time, residents realized that one day was not enough time to celebrate the culture of Bermuda's people. So the entire month of May became Heritage Month. And with that, we unfortunately have run out of time today. The name of this article was "This Island Has a Month-Long Holiday Celebration" by Jocelyn Greenberg. You've been listening to the National Geographic Society program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your Sun Sounds volunteer reader today. I hope you enjoyed the program, and I hope you found it informative. The articles I've read today were all published by the Geographic Society in May of 2025. Stay well, stay safe, and have a wonderful week, and keep listening to the programming offered by Sun Sounds of Arizona on a 24/7 basis. And if you missed a program you'd like to hear, go to the sunsounds.org, click on the broadcast info and audio on the first screen. On the second screen, find the words Demand Podcasts. Click on that. You'll see a list of programs available to you. Hopefully, you'll find the one you're looking for. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.